BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dialect for Saturday, the 18th of July. This week, a bit of an espionage special. We hear from American student Carol Holman about the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and we have the second part of our four-part series looking at 21st century espionage and backdoors to computer software and operating systems. Rebecca Lloyd, who's live in the studio with us to chat about her aunt, Flossie Harsant. She was a native New Zealander. In fact, most of her relatives are New Zealanders, and she's discovered that she wrote a book. We have the latest instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve, and Jeff's here too with What's On later on in the show. But first, I'd like to welcome into the studio Rebecca Lloyd. Hello.
Hello.
So you are originally, you're of British stock, but you're mostly, you have a lot of New Zealand ancestry, is that the right way to say it?
No, I'm a New Zealander.
Or yourself,
John.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Okay, I understand, I don't know very little about New Zealand geographically, but there's North Island and South, is that right?
There is North Island, South Island, and we came from the North Island.
So have you got many relatives left back in New Zealand then?
No, I think there's only my mother. She's very old. And we have some Harsant relatives, and I don't know them because I actually haven't been back to New Zealand. I was taken away when I was born and haven't returned.
Oh, I see. OK, I was going to say, because you have a very British accent. So
I certainly do.
You certainly do. Whereabouts in Britain were you brought up?
Well, many places, really.
Many places, Britain, okay. Yeah. So what age were you when you first discovered about the legacy of Flossie Harsant, and how is she related to you?
Mm. She's my great-aunt, and I didn't find out about her until 2004, when I would have been sort of in my 50s.
Okay.
And I discovered her because my father had written about her in his autobiography.
Right, okay. So what first drew you to wanted to find out more? What was it about her? What did you discover about your Flossie?
Well, I discovered that there are lots of parallels in our lives together. You know, for example, I worked in Africa as a medical parasitologist.
Yeah.
And she was a community nurse in New Zealand amongst Maori people, who she spent all her life with.
Mm.
So what I think I really discovered about her was how closely my family was connected with the Maori kingdom in New Zealand. I hadn't known that
at all,
because we are Pakeha. In other words, we are white.
Okay, so that's the Maori equivalent of genteel for people who are not Maori, who are us white folk.
Say that again?
Well, the Jews call people who are not Jews Gentiles, so that the Pakeha, if you like, is the Maori equivalent. It's what they call white people who are not people who are not Maori.
Yeah, it's just an ordinary word for, and it's a word used by white New Zealanders as well.
Oh, I see. Okay, so yeah. They call themselves that. So how culturally sort of connected to New Zealand did you feel? Bearing in mind you spent all of your life in Britain, did you feel have you travelled there too?
I haven't. I was brought up in Australia for the most part. So, and then we moved between Australia and England. And although I had, you know, a couple of my sisters went back to live in New Zealand and my mother went back there eventually, I haven't done. I meant to, but time goes on and I'm kind of busy.
Okay. She was a writer, your Aunt Flossie. I mean, what sort of stuff did she write?
She wrote for a New Zealand newspaper called the Daily Exporter. In fact, what happened to her when she married Horace Harsant? He was a farmer, and he took her to a place called Harhei, which is very remote, and she apparently didn't like cows, and so she wasn't terribly good at being a farmer's wife.
Mm.
And she took to writing articles. Later, she wrote short stories, which were pretty awful, and because I've read them. But she made quite a lot of money out of writing articles for the New Zealand Daily Exporter under little pen names like Quicksilver or Trouser Button and all sorts of other odd things. And so effectively she was a writer.
Okay, and this has a parallel in your life. You talk about the uncanny parallels with your life. You are
yes,
also a writer.
I am also a writer, primarily a short story writer, although I have had to move into the novel writing business, and that's probably to my advantage. But I love short story, and I teach creative writing, and we use short story as the, you know, system.
Okay, what's the, sort of briefly, do you think is the major advantage? What drew you to short stories more than novels? What is it about the form that you find so attractive?
Well, in the same way that Flossie wrote down, wrote in her diary a lot of her experiences with the Maori folk, I started keeping a diary in Africa when I was working in Tanzania, in a rather remote place up on the mountains. And from the extraordinary stories that were told to me, I began to sort of almost automatically start not recording them, but actually writing the stories themselves.
Okay.
And then, of course, you know, that's how you start to write fiction. And I haven't stopped since.
Okay.
So I started writing effectively in 1994.
So you say Flossie had a very sort of close relationship with the Maoris. How close was that relationship?
Close enough so that when she did die, she had two ceremonies, one a Pakeha service and another was a Maori service, because the Maoridom was not prepared to give her up. Because, you know, in their eyes, they owned Flossie.
Wow, that's...
She's very important to them.
Yeah. What did she do for them?
Well, you know, as a nurse, she was dealing with the smallpox outbreak when...
that would have been 1918?
That would have been probably in 1918, exactly. And there was also an influenza epidemic, which I think is fairly well known about, isn't it, about that time?
Mm.
And she, in fact, formed these unions, because at the age of 22, that was in 1913, she was the Maori organiser of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And I don't actually think, and my mother once told me, that Flossie wasn't actually really very religious, but you can imagine that, you know, in New Zealand of the time, there weren't very many different kind of organisations you could get involved with.
Yeah.
And she first encountered them when she was 16 in 1907. So she went back to work for them, and because she could speak Maori, which very few Pakeha people could, this was her job. She was sent off on horseback across the North Island, age 22, to convert, mainly it was Maori women, into forming these unions, temperance unions, because there was an awful lot of drunkenness at the time.
Right, okay.
Amongst Maori people who were being who were working for logging companies and being paid in wine and so forth. So it was a pretty desperate situation. And my own relatives approved of all what they called all this hanging about with the Maoris and riding around with the Maoris.
Okay.
And the Maori men gave her a hard time as well. And sometimes their women were afraid to tell them, you know, afraid they didn't want to go against their husbands.
So she seems like a bit of a sort of a saintly Florence Nightingale for the Maori women almost. Sort of.
I wouldn't probably call her saintly. I mean, to do what she did at that age, in those circumstances, I'd just call her incredibly practical.
Okay.
And a real good humanist.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I understand. You brought along a little story that she's written as a sort of an example of her writings, I understand. Would you share that with us?
Mm. This is a story which isn't in the book that she wrote, which is called, they called me T. Mari, because they couldn't pronounce Flossie. It's too hard for them. So they called her, middle name is Maria.
Okay,
so
Miriam,
hence the name.
Okay.
And it's not in, it's a piece that I have, I'm not sure, other people will have this, but it's not in the book.
Okay.
But before I read it, just to say a couple of the Maori words and what they mean. A pa is a settlement. Tapu really means taboo, I think. And a pakeha is a white person, as I've already said. And a tohunga is a witch doctor.
Right.
And just as I had my own relationships with witch doctors in Africa, another parallel, she did in New Zealand.
Okay.
And so she's called this the... She wrote this, and I edited it slightly just to make it a little bit better and to shorten it. The Tapu Oysters, and it goes this way. I was to visit a pa to hold a meeting on the branch of the Kaipara Harbour, and a young man and his sister, Ngara, were to go with me. We swam our horses across the river at full tide and then rode 9 miles across country to the pa. Some of the girls there took me for a walk along the beach. At the end of it was a high promontory and at its foot many fat oysters. I'd gone ahead of the girls and I'd eaten several of the oysters before they caught up with me. They were horrified when they saw what I was doing. They told me the oysters were nourished by the bodies of their ancestors who were buried up on top of the cliff in an old burial ground, and therefore anything growing at its base was tapu. That made me very worried because, having lived with Maoris all my life, I knew how serious it was to ignore tapu. When we got back to the pa, we were subdued, but nobody said anything to the elders. I think we were all hoping I'd escape the results of my action. After our meeting, and that would have been the Temperance Union meeting, during which I felt faint, a fire was lit outside and we had tea and camp oven bread. Later some songs were sung and speeches made, but by that time I felt terrible and Ngaru and I were taken to a house and I was put to bed. As I felt myself becoming light-headed, I heard Ngaru telling the old women about the oysters. The strange thing was that although I had no control over my body, my pakeha mind seemed to be watching from above. I could see my writhing body on the bed and people holding me, and at the foot of the bed was the figure of an old tohunga. Several women were kneeling in prayer, while this man was chanting ancient incantations loudly, commanding the spirit that had entered my body to leave. Suddenly, I called out a Maori man's name, and I became instantly still. The tohunga asked if I knew the man, and I didn't. He said a man of that name had been buried on top of the cliff long ago, and it was his spirit that had caused my illness. The next day, the women told me that if I had been a Maori, I most likely would have died. You might say, oh, probably a touch of food poisoning from the oysters or too much sun, but the pakeha have not yet fathomed the many practices and beliefs of the old Maori people. I have lived amongst them and have seen many strange happenings. Tohungas have so much power over people that they can either heal or kill. In a way, there is a similarity in the Australian Aboriginals, who, in spite of our doctor's skills, will die if a bone is pointed at them.
That is fascinating, especially to hear that, that sort of first-hand, if you like, sort of...
Yes. And it was one of a lot of sort of, if you like, not exactly clashes she had with the tohunga, but you know there were several warnings made to her by these men. They were very powerful.
So tell me a little bit about where we can get the books. To why not? I mean, if people want to sort of be able to read or hear more about this.
Well, I had to get it. I mean, I can tell you what it's called, and I can tell you who published it. Mm-hmm. They called me T. Marie, which is T-E-M-A-A-R-I, and it's by Florence Harsant.
Which is H-A-R-S-A-N-T.
And it was published by Whitcoulls, and that's W-H-I-T-C-O-U-L-L-S, publishers, in 1979.
Okay.
And I had to get my copy by finding a New Zealand sort of, not exactly rare books publisher, but, you know, a New Zealand bookshop with old books in it.
It's always worth, at this juncture, pointing out the internet, which is a fantastic finder of books. You'll find a lot of books in there. It would be impossible to find otherwise. Bookfinder.com is at least one of very many books. But yes, they called me Te Māori by Florence Harsant. And Rebecca, thank you very much for coming in today. And
And may I just mention, before I leave you...
Oh, yes.
My,
you did want to say this, yes.
I did want to say. I did want to say that I run creative writing classes...
You do.
..in the Grant Bradley Gallery in the daytime, and I will be running them in Borders in September.
Okay.
Okay.
The Grant Bradley Gallery is in Bedminster by the Asda.
That's exactly right, and anybody who wanted to get hold of me could certainly get me through there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and best of luck.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our first feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with American student Carol Holman from Seattle, Washington. She's talking about the National Security Education Program and the CIA.
I'm an American university student, and I'm studying in Brazil for a year via a scholarship from the National Security Education Program. The way that the scholarship got set up is that we spend a ridiculous amount of money on defense, and unlike most of the federal departments, they often have money left over, and so they do this thing called appropriation. And it's when you earmark money for certain stuff. And sometimes you earmark things that are completely different than what the money actually comes from. So this one senator, Boren from Ohio, after the Cold War ended, when they were sending people over to the former Soviet Union to try to do rebuilding stuff and promote capitalism, 'cause, and democracy, apparently, they realized that they had very, 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 very few people who spoke any of the languages who were spoken in the former Soviet Union, and that that was a huge thing that was hampering their efforts. And so this senator introduced the National Security Education Program as a defense appropriations bill, which means he took about, I don't know how much the endowment is, but it's about $1 million a year that they spend giving out these scholarships. Actually, it might be $2 million, because they have a couple different programs. But the point is to take university students, undergraduates and graduate students, and send them overseas to non-European countries to learn languages that then when they graduate, they'll work for at least a year in the federal government and use those languages within the federal government. So about half the people that do it are like me, and we want to go into the State Department, or we want to go into USAID, or we're just willing to do some shit secretary job somewhere in exchange for the $20,000 that they give us to study abroad. And then the other half really want to go into CIA, FBI, or more serious defense stuff. Yes. I personally have no interest in the CIA. Pretty much every country I've gone to that I've ever cared about was screwed over by the CIA at some point between the 1950s and the 1980s. So.
Do you know anything about the dictators in South America? Someone, an Argentinian.
Which ones?
An Argentinian told us that the dictators, like Pinochet, etc., have been trained in America by the CIA.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I know lots about that. You see, when I was 15, the school that my parents sent me to by myself was run by ex-guerrillas from the Civil War, which started when 1956, when this US CIA went in and backed a coup against a democratically elected left-wing government that had started a land reform program.
Which country was this?
Guatemala.
Oh, right, Guatemala, yeah.
That had started a land reform program. And they were taking, there was a lot of land that this U.S. company, United Fruit, which is now Dole, owned but wasn't using and hadn't used for years and years and years and years and years. And so the government paid Dole for United Fruit for the amount of money that Dole had said the land was worth on their tax returns, which was very little. And United Fruit complained, said that it was a socialist, communist thing. And the CIA backed a coup. And that was the first of many coups that we supported in Latin America, including Chile, Brazil, Argentina. I think Chile was the last one. That was 72, 73.
So do you know anything more about the inside politics, American politics?
No, I don't know. We haven't... See, I studied Latin America. So at least within Latin America, we haven't, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm looking back as fast as I can right now, we haven't supported a direct coup since Chile. We've definitely propped up dictatorial, genocidal governments for various reasons.
Argentina.
Yeah, in Argentina. God, when did that end? Was that 89?
It was in the 70s, I think.
Yeah, but I think he went out of power in 89. The thing is, well, first of all, the Cold War ended, and that was our main excuse, justification, reason for propping up a lot of these governments.
Was it a worry about communism spreading?
Mm-hmm.
To Latin America?
Because Latin America was definitely, like, they were, various different countries were electing socialist communist governments from the 50s through the 70s. And so there was definitely a real fear that that Latin America would go communist. And since the Monroe Doctrine, we've kind of felt that Latin America is our backyard and we have the right to do whatever we want. And there's tons of U.S. business interests that are involved in Latin America, and if they go, if anyone goes socialist, they generally nationalize a lot of the more profitable businesses, which includes especially a lot of natural oil, gas, mining, things like that. That the U.S.
water.
Has.
Is water commodity?
Water has become one, but in the 50s and 70s it wasn't. We haven't been militarily involved in Latin America for a long time, and so I'm hoping. I've heard rumors that this isn't. Not necessarily just with Obama. I mean, I think that things will become more friendly with Latin American governments because of Obama. I hope that our period of militarily pushing our interests in Latin America is over. Morally, I think we've come a long way from that, and or I hope. And economically,
with the new election,
partly with yes, a lot of with Obama, but also, I mean, I think that the American people aren't as, and this might be because we're currently involved in Iraq, and so that's given a lot of people a wake up call. But we're definitely not as willing to go in militarily as we were 10 years ago.
What sort of powers America, the general American public got in these decisions?
It really depends. Like, I led walkouts from my middle school when I was 13. No, we had, millions and millions of people demonstrating against it. And we still went out.
So it didn't make any difference?
What?
It didn't make any difference?
No. Because those policies were already set. We'd already elected that administration. We already had the people in power. And we had already chosen to have those people in power that would make those decisions.
But do you think those elections were fair the last time around with Bush or Rick?
No, he didn't win the majority. Like, screw the Electoral College. I know it's in our Constitution, but when it works to the point where Bush can take office without getting the majority of the votes, then we need to have a constitutional conference and we need to change it. Because that's not how it should be working.
And do you think Obama will change that?
No, I doubt the Electoral College will be changed because it's been there for so long. We're very, very, very reluctant to change anything in our Constitution because we've had it for so long and it's worked well for us. And so we're very hesitant to change it. And not just as a people being hesitant to change it, but the system that's been set up, it's difficult to change it. It's very difficult to get 75%.
If it allows someone like Bush to get in
without the majority vote, then the...
It's not really working, is it?
The bare majority that elected Kerry will support it, would support a constitutional change, and the bare majority that elected Bush would not, which doesn't give you enough people to change the constitution. To sum it up, I definitely think things will be better. Well, because of what we're involved in now, I think we're going to be a lot more cautious in our politics.
That was Anthea Page interviewing Carol Holman, an American university student. And the interview took place in a cafe in Potosí, Bolivia, in February earlier this year.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And here's a piece that producer Tony Gosling spotted in The Private Eye, and he wanted me to sort of point this out. It's under the section of The Private Eye called Rotten Boroughs, and the headline is FIFO Silver Lining, and the piece goes like this. Rampant paranoia among supporters of Southwest One, the harebrained £500 million outsourcing joint venture between Somerset County Council, Avon and Somerset Police and IBM. i1230 reported how Chief Constable Colin Port had spent more than £90,000 of public money on libel lawyers Carter Ruck in an attempt to intimidate local BBC and ITV hacks who had raised questions about the accountability and transparency of the scheme, in which hundreds of council and police staff have transferred to the new company in the name of increased efficiency and cost saving. Port was particularly annoyed at suggestions of a conflict of interest because his wife, Susan Barnes, was the County Council's director for the project. Now, Port's ally and joint cheerleader for the scheme, Somerset County Council Chief Executive Alan Jones, is looking foolish after a vindictive campaign against a prominent critic badly backfired. Jones, who tells staff his managerial credo is fit in, or F off, or F-I-F-O, FIFO, has it in for the council's former Lib Dem deputy leader Paul Buchanan, a persistent critic of South West One. Jones made dozens of complaints against Buchanan to the Standards Board for England, alleging secretiveness, undermining staff, aggressive and threatening behaviour, rudeness, intimidation, anger, disrespect, fraud, sexism, racism and homophobia. The SBE spent 2 years and many thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money investigating the claims, finally rejecting them all except one at the end of March. Having been expelled from the Lib Dem group and stripped of his committee posts and deputy leadership, Buchanan has received a censure, the mildest sanction the SBE can deliver, for being careless in allowing others to hear him swear under his breath. Speaking in an adjournment debate in the Commons last week, Ian Littlegranger, Tory MP for Bridgewater, accused Jones of deliberate deceit and victimisation. He set out to destroy Paul Buchanan. The tactics Jones used make Damien McBride look like an angel. Jones is currently abroad, singing the praises of South West One. At a presentation in Washington, D.C., he described it as, quote, innovative beyond public imagination. A typical nugget of nonsense from a man who won this column's Blue Sky Thinker of the Year award in 2005. Well, could it be possibly that Tony Gosling is producing this show? I think so. This is another intro and outro that he's written up for us. Israeli spying. Part two of our four-part series now, and espionage has come a long way since the Second World War, and hacking is not just for geeks, it is becoming another tool of war. Tonight we have the second of a four-part series by journalist Carl Cameron about the presence of Israeli spies in the United States and the links to Israeli software companies and the Israeli mafia. What makes this industry so dangerous is that there are big Israeli government subsidies for these software companies which allow them to underbid their competitors. Their software has hidden back doors so that it can be accessed remotely by the manufacturers and their so-called friends.
We reported on the approximately 60 Israelis who had been detained in connection with the September 11th terrorism investigation. Carl Cameron reported that U.S. investigators suspect that some of these Israelis were spying on Arabs in this country and may have turned up information on the planned terrorist attacks back in September that was not passed on. Tonight, in the second of four reports on spying by Israelis in the U.S., we learn about an Israeli-based private communications company for whom a half dozen of those 60 detained suspects worked. American investigators fear information generated by this firm may have fallen into the wrong hands and had the effect of impeding the September 11th terror inquiry. Here's Carl Cameron's second report.
Fox News has learned that some American terrorism investigators fear certain suspects in the September 11th attacks may have managed to stay ahead of them by knowing who and when investigators are calling on the telephone. How? By obtaining and analyzing data that's generated every time someone in the U.S. makes a phone call.
One sitting and say, please.
Here's how the system works. Most directory assistance calls and virtually all call records and billing in the U.S. are done for the phone companies by Amdocs Limited, an Israeli-based private telecommunications company. Amdocs has contracts with the 25 biggest phone companies in America and more worldwide. The White House and other secure government phone lines are protected, but it is virtually impossible to make a call on normal phones without generating an Amdocs record of it. In recent years, the FBI and other government agencies have investigated Amdocs more than once. The firm has repeatedly and adamantly denied any security breaches or wrongdoing. But sources tell Fox News that in 1999, the super-secret National Security Agency, headquartered in Northern Maryland, issued what's called a top-secret, sensitive, compartmentalized information report, TSSCI, warning that records of calls in the United States were getting into foreign hands, in Israel in particular. Investigators do not believe calls are being listened to, but the data about who's calling whom and when is plenty valuable in itself. An internal Amdocs memo to senior company executives suggests just how Amdocs-generated call records could be used, quote, widespread data mining techniques and algorithms, combining both the properties of the customer, like credit rating, and properties of the specific behavior. Specific behavior such as whom the customers are calling. The Amdocs memo says the system should be used to prevent phone fraud, but U.S. counterintelligence analysts say it could also be used to spy through the phone system. Fox News has learned that the NSA has held numerous classified conferences to warn the FBI and CIA how Amdocs records could be used. At one NSA briefing, a diagram by the Argonne National Lab was used to show that if the phone records are not secure, major security breaches are possible. Another briefing document said, quote, it has become increasingly apparent that systems and networks are vulnerable. Such crimes always involve unauthorized persons or persons who exceed their authorization, acting on exploitable vulnerabilities. Those vulnerabilities are growing because, according to another briefing, the U.S. relies too much on foreign companies like Amdocs for high-tech equipment and software, quote, many factors have led to increased dependence on code developed overseas. We buy rather than train or develop solutions. U.S. intelligence does not believe the Israeli government is involved in a misuse of Amdocs information, and Amdocs insists that its data is secure. What U.S. government officials are worried about, however, is the possibility that Amdocs data could get into the wrong hands, particularly organized crime, and that would not be the first time that such a thing has happened. Fox News has documents of a 1997 drug trafficking case in Los Angeles in which telephone information, the types that Amdocs collects, was used to, quote, completely compromise the communications of the FBI, the Secret Service, the DEA, and the LAPD. And we'll have that and a lot more in the days ahead, Brett.
Carl, I want to take you back to your report last night on those 60 people who, Israelis who were detained in the anti-terror investigation. And the suspicion that some investigators have that they may have picked up information on the 9/11 attacks ahead of time, not passed it on. There was a report, you'll recall, that the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, did indeed send representatives to the U.S. to warn just before 9/11 that a major terrorist attack was imminent. Why does that not, how does that leave room for the lack of a warning?
Well, I remember the report, Britt. We did it first internationally right here on your show on the 14th. What investigators are saying is that that warning from the Mossad was nonspecific and general, and they believe that it may have had something to do with the desire to protect what are called sources and methods in the intelligence community. The suspicion being perhaps those sources and methods were taking place right here in the United States. The question came up in the Select Intelligence Committee on Capitol Hill today. They intend to look into what we reported last night and specifically that possibility, Brett.
So, in other words, the problem wasn't the lack of a warning. The problem was lack of the, of useful details.
Quantity of information.
All right, Carl. Thanks very much.
That was journalist Carl Cameron on Israeli spying and links to software companies producing phone billing information. And more of that next week, part 3 of 4.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's now time for Malcolm Grieve to read another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. As you'll recall, if you've been listening to previous episodes, in the 1920s, in 1922 to be precise, John Fothergill moved to Thame in Oxfordshire to run an inn. He'd never done it before, so he didn't know quite what to expect, and the people and customs that he came across were not quite what he was expecting. And he wrote about his experiences in a diary.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. After many days of unsullied pleasantness, we've had a day of loathsomeness which began last night at 12:30 a.m. when an old woman looking like a procuress with a very pretty girl and an old car riding on its near hind rim asked for rooms and food at 1 in the morning. I gave them delicious food and 2 wonderful beds, breakfast in a sunny little room, and took them into a gorgeous garden. Then they complained to Katie about having to pay 1 shilling for garage because their filthy little car had been left in the yard and not inside the garage. So Katie took off the shilling. I caught the pretty girl on the steps outside. "I'm sorry about that shilling for the garage," I said. "Oh, it's all right," she replied with a forgiving air. Then I gave her and the old woman 4 minutes talking to by the town hall clock. The Fagans left after a fortnight's stay, after which I was pulled out of the garden to see an old man in a Rolls Royce with a pretty girl who wanted me to put up a poster for a highbrow handicraft show in Oxford, which I declined, and he went off. I had to talk to an undergraduate for sprawling on his chair and putting his feet on the mantelshelf. A woman and husband then came in a Chrysler to sell me McCoy's English Furniture, and when I said I had it already, they asked me where they should go next. I told them that their method was a wrong one. And in the evening I took up to number 7, our best room, an awful couple of people, having already 3 commercials in the house, and he said to his miserable wife, "Will this do?" But happily, we had 17 very decent folks to dinner, which rounded off the bad day, and Hogarth, Ashmolean Museum, rang up to say that they couldn't come to dine after all because their car had broken down, and would I send the bill? Antique politeness. Questionings, misgivings. As you get more and more tired out and in need of a holiday, you worry more and more about the food and the people. Is the food good enough? And aren't the people too kind? To the first question, I have to bear in mind always that the dinner is only 5 shillings. The usual price at places where the food is uneatable, in rooms unbearable, on white cotton tablecloths, partaken either solitary or with any old kind of lodger or passer-by. I have to force myself to believe that about 2 hours working at the food myself in the kitchen before dinner and seeing to the helping on each plate must tell the tale to the eater of it unless I am an imbecile, and that a steady increase of people even in bad times is a proof that our efforts are successful. But meals fail at times from beginning to end, and sometimes the super smart come from London expecting Boulistan. Bertie Meyer, for instance, with a party of exquisites, asked for salad in midwinter with a Sunday lunch. And last night, a splendid Hispano-Suiza slid up the yard covered with escutcheons. "Belgian embassy?" I asked the silver-grey chauffeur as I passed him in the bar. "No, sir. Spanish royal family." They were a pretty girl and her husband, with 3 gentlemen who looked like butlers discharged for taking liberties. The pretty girl said they'd heard the food was so good, but as it was not à la carte, she would eat almost nothing, and the meal was bad in any case, and we had no time to make nice things, there being 50 others dining at the time. I didn't mind the royalty so much, but I feel it so rude to disappoint, foreigners especially. But when people come again and again, how can you reward them? You feel you must. Yet if you do, for instance, give them a bottle of wine, when are you to repeat the dose? Or will they feel compelled to drink wine on the next occasion when they might not want it? And mind some, for that reason, avoid you altogether. How are you to face people who, after coming regularly, have you to a splendid meal at their own homes, and then come and dine the following day, and you let them have the bill? We ourselves can't have dinner parties here, for we are busy just at that time, and so I resort to little gifts of Greek honey, or the banal giving of a glass of good brandy, and wonder how it's all going to pan out, this debit and credit account. Perhaps, most certainly, we shall never get out of debt with these nice folks who make our lives bearable or delightful. But we must include all in the common ledger, to find that the nice folks merely pay for the few disgruntled ones who try to treat us like coolies, but don't come again. Or make a still more inclusive account, to find that we are getting kindness and affection, because so many other places are loathsome. It was exciting to have here the Reverend Laughing Hugh Embling, before going to Korea to be bishop, because Clark Hall once told me the story about him asking for a lot of young criminals to be sent to a bit of a farm he had in Essex. "Here you are," he said to them. "This is your farm, and you are responsible for it. Get on with it." After a week, all the tiles had been stripped from the roof, and every implement made useless. Soon afterwards, it became a going concern in their hands. Whatever the influence of this striking personality effected, Embling was modest and humorous enough to add to the story that he had a very useful and muscular sailor to look after the boys. Peter and Kathleen Clegg, RN, came here for 10 days honeymoon. They were both so beautiful, but she especially lovely, like the Helen on the Macron vase, and their ways were so charming that they ate into our minds. They lunched again here, on their anniversary. Romney Summers brought a man in to dinner. He told me he had overtaken him just outside Oxford, and then they had raced here, and then going level up the straight into the town, he'd invited him to dine here. They had a magnum between them. Afterwards, Romney backed his faithful Vauxhall through the archway out into the street. I said I wish you wouldn't do that. Coaches and fours didn't do it. Besides, it looks as if we hadn't any room inside. Then followed the other with his Bentley, backing out also. I told him the same story, and when he knocked up against the side, I added, "In any case, you can't drive for little apples." Each of them apologised quietly. Romney then told me that the other man was Clement, who at that same moment, having now got his car into position for answering my charge of little apples, seemed to lift it bodily up and jumped into the darkness like a thunderbolt. Romney drove the other day from Glasgow here, 430 miles, isn't it, at an average of 36 miles per hour, which is nothing compared to the beautiful Lady Marjorie Dalrymple Hamilton, who told me she took her two children in a small car from London to Ayrshire, 450 miles in a day. Slow infanticide, someone said when I told him of it. Oliver Baldwin came to dinner early, and as he was hanging about when three respectable Hull solicitors arrived for the night with their luggage, Oliver, just like his kindness, offered to help me with them upstairs. Loaded with two big bags, he stood patiently whilst they allotted their rooms. At dinner I asked them, "How are you getting on?" And they replied, "We are mightily pleased with our quarters." To which I added, "And what do you think of the porter of your luggage, the Prime Minister's son?" Which made them sit up. Oliver wants to abolish the public schools and have all educated alike, as indeed most of us parents would, so that the Duchess and her daughters may be scullery maids, if they shall have been beaten in the race, by those who are scullery maids now. Anything, I suppose, to get us better scullery maids, for I'm sure that those we have now would make far better duchesses, and far more daughters.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve for reading excellently another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, at this juncture, eagle-eared listeners will recognise the name of the person who's written a book that I've got in front of me, David Southwell. He's written a book called Secrets and Lies, which is his latest book. We've read instalments of The History of the Mafia by this gentleman in previous weeks, and I think Tony is still trying to track this man down, so we get an interview. I'm sure it would be very fascinating. I'll flick through. There's lots and lots and lots of sort of three or four paragraph articles, all with a headline, and they're all revolving around the theme of secrets and lies under various sort of topic headings. So I've just sort of flicked through and I found one that all sort of fascinating. This headline jumped out at me because we've just had an article about the CIA. The headline that David Southwell claims is, "The CIA has agents in every major broadcaster from the BBC to the CNN. A modest claim, but truth really can be stranger than fiction. So I'll just read you what he's written about it and let's see what he's got to say. When it comes to having a cover for your information gathering role as an intelligence agent, there are a few better than that of journalist. After all, they stick their noses in other people's business and ferret out secrets. The role of the journalist gives you direct access to the media, making the spread of misinformation a lot easier. It also allows you to influence the news agenda and know firsthand who other reporters' sources of information are. This is why, since the 1950s, the Central Intelligence Agency has worked tirelessly to place deep cover agents in major national and international broadcasters and key newspapers. They have also developed a network of reporters who feed information into them in return for material for their stories. A leaked internal CIA memo to a former CIA director is highly revealing. It describes how, and he quotes here, "We have agents and contacts with every major news wire service, newspaper, news weekly and television network in the nation," end quote. It also reveals how they have successfully had stories scrapped and changed the way intelligence issues had been covered. The CIA currently has agents working both in American news networks and key foreign broadcasters such as the BBC and Al Jazeera. While the war in Kosovo was raging, the Dutch newspaper Trouw, T-R-O-U-W, so excuse the pronunciation possibly, uncovered how five members of the US Army Intelligence, all specialists in psychological warfare, or PsyOps, were working at CNN in news production. With their cover blown, they returned to their regular duties at 4th Psychological Operations Group stationed at Fort Bragg. CNN later stated they had in no way been, quote, journalistically compromised. Really? The practice of using journalists as agents is nothing new. After he left Naval Intelligence in 1945, Ian Fleming, the creator of the James Bond, became foreign manager for Kemsley Newspapers, which owned titles including the Sunday Times. Fleming set up a separate news agency to supply the papers with foreign news. Many of his hand-picked journalists were also working for MI6, gathering intelligence and reflecting the service's views in their reporting. I think we'll have more of David Southwell's book Secrets and Lies in the following weeks. That was very interesting. In some ways, I don't suppose many people will be hugely surprised, as a lot of it is kind of common sense. But it is worth quoting, particularly because he backs it up with quotes and source material, so he does seem to know what he's talking about. Well, here's another little bit about conspiracy. As I said earlier, can you tell Tony Gosling's producing this week's show? This is a blog that has been censored from Tory MP Nadine Dorris. She had a blog that she wrote censored by order of the Daily Telegraph, or in particular the Barclay brothers, who own the Daily Telegraph. It was originally posted on Thursday, the 21st of May 2009, at exactly 17:04, if you wanted to know that. And this is it. Just park a couple of facts for a moment, which you may not agree with, but are factual. The first is that MPs have always been encouraged, by whatever means possible, to draw down their ACA allowance in full. This is because it was upped in place of an appropriate pay rise. The rules surrounding the ACA were deliberately sloppy in order to maximise the opportunity that MPs had to draw. This was always felt to be the safest political method to remunerate MPs rather than face the media backlash of a pay rise. Parliament is in chaos. The public are angry and the Telegraph has upped its circulation. There are 650 members of Parliament. In any walk of life, in whatever profession, you will find people who are dishonest. It will always be thus, as long as we are all human. The Telegraph are uncovering a few cases of fraud, but not enough, so they are more than slightly embellishing some of the stories I write as a case in point. Enter the Barclay brothers, the billionaire owners of the Daily Telegraph. Rumour is that they are fiercely Eurosceptic and do not feel that either of the main parties are Eurosceptic enough. They have set upon a deliberate course to destabilise Parliament with the hope that the winners will be UKIP and BNP. And sure enough, and this is me speaking as well, sure enough they have received a lot more press of late in light of the local council elections. Back to her blog, she says, a quick online check of the Barclay brothers and their antics on the island of Sark is enough to give this part of the rumour credence. She quotes a couple of Guardian website addresses. I won't quote them mostly because it wouldn't make a lot of sense, but certainly if you search, the Guardian has published newspapers about what the Barclay brothers have been up to on the island of Sark, particularly in reference to the democratic elections and the Barclay brothers being kicked off the island. She continues, another rumour is that the disc was never acquired and sold by an amateur, but it was in fact a long-term undercover operation run by the Telegraph for some considerable time, carefully planned and executed, and that the stories of the naive disc nabber ringing the news desk in an attempt to sell the stolen information are entirely the work of gossip and fiction. These rumours do have some credibility, given that all of this has erupted during the European election campaign, and turnout is expected to be high with protest votes, courtesy of the Daily Telegraph, or should I say, the Barclay brothers. Now, if this is all a power game executed by the Barclay brothers, how would they do that? It is a fact that these men are no fools and are in fact self-made billionaires. I would imagine and believe that if any of this is true, they know the British psyche well enough to whip up a mood of public anger, hence the long-running revelations in the Daily Telegraph. Where do I get this from? Well, at heart, I'm just a cheeky scouser. I like to go into the rooms of the faceless and the nameless in Parliament, sit on their desk and ask pertinent questions like, who are you? What do you do? I've made friends with one or two. One in particular I'm very fond of. He's a mine of very astute information. While in his office yesterday, we chattered over, what is this all about question. He reckons this is all a power game, that the British public are being worked like puppets by two very powerful men, whipped up into a frenzy to achieve exactly what they want. His very poignant words to me were, quote, if any of this conjecture is true, Parliament will become full of racists, fanaticists and has-been celebrities. We will be rendered impotent and may never again regain the authority to withstand the pressure, opinion and whims of the overtly wealthy. Scary stuff. And there is a web address for the Tory MP Nadine Dorris, which is kind of overly complicated and it doesn't come across very well in radio because you won't remember. So I'm sure if you Google Tory MP Nadine Dorris, which is spelled D-O-R-R-I-E-S, and you'll be able to find that. In fact, I think if you just put in blog.dorries.org, that hopefully should come up. As a suffix, as I said earlier, I mean, that you won't find this specific blog on there because it's as per orders of lawyers employed by the Barker brothers that this has been removed. But you'll certainly find her other blogs, and I'm sure she's got plenty of interesting things to say.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, let's have a little pleasant break from all the conspiracies and welcome Jeff Sparks, who is seated here wearing a black T-shirt advertising Motorhead, a badge advertising Spit Like This, who you've mentioned in previous weeks and are very fond of, and also a website on a badge that says Smell Your Mum. Would you like to enlighten us as to what this website is?
Basically, smellyourmum.com is the T-shirt and accessories website company run by Spit Like This. And basically, everything everyone buys from that site, all the money, goes back into helping the band keep the website running, basically keep the band running themselves.
Okie doke. Well, in the age of downloadable tracks and record companies losing money, of course, the only way artists are going to be able to make any money is by buying their T-shirts. So feel free, if you like Spit Like This and you like Jeff music Jeff plays, to log on to their website and buy a T-shirt.
Thank you, John. Right. Good evening, this is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 23rd July, and Last Orders will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £3 in advance and £5 on the door. Also on 23rd of July, Testament will be performing with support from Onslaught at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Moving on to Friday, 24th of July, and the seven-piece jive band Honey Bee and the Kings of Sting will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Cheap Cuts. This group hail from Warrington and are currently on a busking tour around the country. I saw them performing in Bristol the other day and was quite impressed. This is from the CD they are selling at their performances, and it's a track titled An Old Photograph.
At home beneath the strip lights of the classroom in Block C, I'd copy from your notes because your writing was so neat and could quote you on the line for me. You said that one day we'd kiss, although I knew our friendship would never end with this. What I had was a simple joke, I wanted for a wish, screwed into my chest ever since.
was tired of waiting for you to make a fool of me. And though I often thought you knew my girlfriend wasn't real, I looked for signs of jealousy. Time to work out what to say, and then, well, if I call round and you're not alone that day, then I'll throw this photograph away. Throw this photograph away.
That was Cheap Cuts with An Old Photograph. I must mention that they were busking in Bristol the other day. For more information on them, you can check out myspace.com/cheapcuts. Moving on to Saturday, 25th of July, and Blackfire will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on 25th of July, the Bombardiers will be performing at the Louisiana in Bristol with support from the Chandelier Falls and also the Richard Harris Band. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. Finally, on to Sunday, 26th of July, Saffron Monkey will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Special shout out to Matthew Page because after last week's show, we had a little production meeting and she actually went to the effort to bake a cake. Especially for me, because it was my birthday. How sweet was that? She actually blew up some balloons and baked cake. It was really tasty as well. I've finished eating it now. It's all gone, and I ate it all, pretty much. Tony Gosling had some as well, but I ate most of it. I took a huge lump of it home, and I thought, this is so nice, I'm not going to share it. I'm going to eat it all myself. Brilliant. Thank you very much, Anthea. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on the BCFM airwaves at 93.2 across the city of Bristol at 9 p.m. every Saturday and repeated at 6 p.m. every Sunday evening, and also in Preston on Preston FM. Hello, Preston. You can find us on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and at bcfm.org.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and being a cooperative, that means anyone can contribute. So if you're out there listening and you'd like to get in touch just to find out what we do, really, you can come along to watch. You can chip in with presenting, I don't have to be the only one, or you can write some scripts or do some engineering. Please get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guest Rebecca Lloyd, and reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthony Page, and the studio production was by Tony Gosling. Thanks very much to Villis Chichgurin for his engineering skills, and to Jeff Sparks for the What's On. This was Dialects, and I'm John Peters Collin, wishing you a very good week. So from all the team in Queen Square, take care of yourselves and enjoy the sunshine.